This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. My name is Miguel Montero. And today we will be talking with Professor Huda Fakhreddin. Professor Huda Fakhreddin is Associate Professor of Arabic Literature at the University of Pennsylvania, and she recently wrote her book, The Arabic Prose Poem, Poetic Theory and Practice, published in 2021 by Edinburgh University Press. She's also the author of Metapoesies in the Arabic Tradition, came out from Brill in 2015, and the co-editor of the Routledge Handbook of Arabic Poetry in 2023. She's a translator of countless books, most recently The Universe All at Once, selection from Salim Bereket, which will be forthcoming in 2024, this year, from Siegel Books, and also of many poems in such places as Lit Hub, Asymptote, Words Without Borders, and I would personally like to single out her translations of poems by the Palestinian poet from Gaza, Hiba Abu Neda, who was murdered by Israeli forces on October 2023, and which were very important for all of us in the first months of the ongoing genocide, as well as her translation of the poem From the River to the Sea by Samir Abu Hawash, which was published earlier this month on Protean Magazine. She has an illustrious career as a scholar of Arabic literature, being the co-editor of Middle Eastern Literatures and an editor of the Library of Arabic Literature. And she has also published a book of creative nonfiction titled Zaman Saghir Taht Shams Thaniya, A Brief Time Under a Different Sun, which was published by Dar al-Nahda in 2019. Professor Fakhreddin, thank you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miguel. Thank you for having me.
It is a pleasure to. It was a pleasure to read this wonderful book. Extremely erudite, extremely elegantly written. It's a pleasure on all levels. I wanted before we get into the how you got to writing it, how all the ideas came to you. Just say a few words. It's a book that touches on the development of the prose poem, the Arabic prose poem within the Arabic literary tradition, focused on the 20th century and the early 21st century, tracking its literary aesthetic developments, its theoretical contradictions, and its resolution, or at least its present state in the early 21st century. How did you get to write a book like this?
That's a good question. It might be the story of my life up to this point, but I'm a student of Arabic poetry. That's the best way I can introduce myself. I think there's no better way to spend one's life than in the shade of Arabic poetry. And I've always been interested in projects of innovation, of change, of modernization, of rebellion inside the Arabic literary tradition. So when I wrote my first book, it was an examination of these two instances, the modernist movement in the first half of the 20th century, and the earlier, probably more courageous and more deeply impactful modernizing moment in the Abbasid age. And the work in the first book looked at the Qasida in its various phases and forms of rebellion and the modernist poem, the free verse poem, the modernist Arabic poem. So I felt that I reached a limit, which was poetry within the parameters of meter, Arabic poetry, but still within the parameters of meter. And while writing the first book, which was actually my dissertation, and I spent a lot of time thinking about these two projects, two modernizing projects, I was already thinking about the prose poem and interested in arriving at it in this study. So I think of these two books as connected and part of the same project. However, writing the book on the prose poem was a little bit more challenging for me on a personal level, because to be honest, I was not convinced. I was probably in the camp of poetry within meter, and maybe still am to a far extent. I was very skeptical about the project and the achievements of the prose poem in Arabic up to that point. So I needed to do a lot of unlearning to write that book. And it was very rewarding, I think, because poetry that triggers us sometimes, even negatively, ends up being the most interesting journeys.
Thank you very much. You mentioned the Qasida. Maybe you could also say a few words for listeners who might not know what the word means, but also the broad problems of the Arabic prose poem as having some sort of an opposition. Could you just give us some terminological orientations, because you speak in your book about the problems of naming and what is a prose poem and what is it saying, what is it reacting, what is it translating or not translating, which is a very important point you make in the book, before we delve into the wider discussion.
Yeah, so the issue of terms is very important. And I think the problem is much more beautiful in Arabic than it is in translation. The term qasida in Arabic, the word qasida, means poem. And it also means a very specific kind of poem in terms of form. The qasida, as the Arabists would translate it, is the archetypal Arabic ode or the Bedouin poem or the classical Arabic poem, all terms to say that it is a formal kind of poetry within strict form. I'm not going to say rigid, because I don't think that classical Arabic prosody is rigid. I think there's a lot of room for variation and change within the seemingly fixed form of the Arabic qasida. But the qasida follows or is composed on 1 meter, 1 out of 16 meters that were deduced after the poetry. So Khalil bin Ahmed, who is the theorist of prosody in Arabic, read a lot of poetry and then identified patterns. And this is how we have the meters of Arabic poetry. So the qasida is monometered. It's written, the entire qasida, it could go on for more than 100 verses, is composed in meter. And mono rhyme. So again, the verses will end with the same sound. And each verse is made up of two hemistichs. So even visually, the qasida looks like this towering structure, two columns. And it's very musical. It's a very strict and measured music. That is the qasida. And we use the term qasida to refer to any poem. So this is where the confusion or the tension or the adventure occurs in you know, examining the terminology. And of course, the problems when we translate these terms. And when we start borrowing terms like free verse to refer to the modernist Arabic poem. So in the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century, with many projects paving the way, so it wasn't a sudden break as some of the studies would make us think, but the free verse poem or qasida at-tafaila replaced the classical Arabic qasida when poets started varying on the meters, allowing themselves more exceptions, and they abandoned the two hemistichs or the verse in favor of the line. And they also abandoned the mono rhyme. So they were able to use more than one sound and to play with internal rhyme. And the word iqa or rhythm came in fashion, is a word that they use a lot to describe the new musicality of the modernist Arabic poem. But still, despite or regardless of all these experimentations, meter was still an element. So the free verse poem or qasida at-tafaila adopts meter in a varied way, variations on the classical meters. It was not until the prose poem, which was introduced in 1960, the theory before the practice. But of course, there are no sudden breaks in poetry or in history, so that we can refer to precursors, to examples of, you know, blurring the dividing line between prose and poetry and challenging meter in the Arabic tradition way back before 1960. But in 1960, the prose poem Qasidat al-Nathr, which in Arabic sounds like an oxymoron, you know, prose is the opposite of qasida, supposedly. And here you have a proposal to write poetry in Arabic outside the parameters of meter altogether. So where the Qasida al-Tafila experimented and stretched Arabic prosody to its limits, the prose poem abandoned it entirely. And this is where the controversy or the problem or the magic happened. It's this the temptation to look for poetry outside familiar or inherited or accepted or acknowledged frameworks.
Thank you very, very much. And in a sense, your book is the story of that journey that does not start completely, but gets going really in a creative adventure after the 60s. And to a large extent, you talk about the people connected with the Sher magazine in Beirut, and the different stances that the people connected with the Sher were taking. Would you tell us a bit about the magazine itself, and then maybe about some of its most representative figures that you focus on in your book?
Yes. So Sher is a magazine that was active and presented itself a little bit.
I might interrupt, meaning poetry.
Meaning poetry, yes. So Sher means poetry, and it was the name of a journal that was active in the 50s and the 60s and presented itself as the platform or the launching platform of Qasidat al-Nathr, or of the prose poem. And it was founded by two poets, Yusuf al-Khal and Adonis. And it attracted experimentalists, people who were interested in, who themselves felt as marginal and had different experimentalist projects, and even in terms of identity, it really foregrounded the marginal and the unheard or the uninstitutionalized. In Sher is where Adonis published his manifesto of the prose poem. Unsi al-Hajj is one of the other theorists of the prose poem, and we think of his introduction to his collection, Len, his first collection, which means it translates as never or won't. We think of the Unsi al-Hajj's introduction and Adonis' manifesto as the two theoretical texts that launched the project.
What are these manifestos saying? They are taking a stance. They are marking a position, a aesthetic position, maybe other things as well, but certainly aesthetic. What are they standing for?
So they were both concerned with defining this new project and describing its characteristics. And they both insist that it is unprecedented in the Arabic poetic tradition, which is not necessarily true. It can be framed to be true depending on how, you know, you frame the argument or phrase it. But it was important to them to present this as something that has never happened before, as a transgression, as, you know, jumping the fence, as I say in the book, the fence of meter that had for a long time defined what poetry is as opposed to what non-poetry is in Arabic. And they are a contradictory text, because, you know, this idea that poetry cannot be defined, but here we are trying to define it. They make a distinction, Unsi al-Hajj makes a distinction between poetry and the poem. And he considers the poem to be the more difficult thing to build or to define or to achieve because it is a structure. So his text is also presents this binary of building and destroying. So to create, to achieve this new aspiration of poetry that's entirely free in Arabic, Uns al-Hajj insists that there must be some destroying that will happen first. And both Adonis and Uns al-Hajj in these texts express a position or stance vis-a-vis the tradition, the Arabic tradition. And this, they present the prose poem as a rebellion or even a liberation from that. Of course, these are opinions that many of the poets in that period will then revise and or maybe even distance themselves from, the way Adonis does. So Adonis, who is still with us and remains very active, has changed his mind on many things and has went back and reassessed many of the projects and the movements that he was involved in, including the prose poem. And he, when he now talks about or reflects on the experience of Sha'r, one of the many things he says is that our stance or our position or our relationship with the Arabic literary tradition was not as mature or as knowledgeable as it should have been. And it's funny that he is the one who says that. He remains one of the most poets of his generation invested in the tradition. He's, you know, the anthologist, the critic, the reader, as opposed to others who were never even interested in creating a relationship with the Arabic poetic tradition, who either used this as a political stance or as a critical stance, or just didn't care. And some of these poets include Uns al-Hajj and Muhammad al-Maghout, and these are poets I study in the book.
And how did they, specifically the time period that you study, because as you mentioned, several of these poets are still alive, are still writing. But how did they, apart from the theoretical perspective or apart from the manifesto-like aspect of the of this new movement that they're trying to create, how were their poems different? What were they doing? In poetic terms or in actual artistic terms?
So they were doing different things. That's another important characteristic of the prose poem in Arabic, is that the prose poem is not one thing. And that is why in the book is arranged in a way where there are poets, as it's a series of case studies, and each of the poets that I focus on is a poet with a different understanding of the prose poem, a different style, a different approach or posture from it as a project in practice. And in practice, the theory they might all agree on, some of the big aspirations, but in practice they differ from each other a lot. But the common thing that they were all doing is abandoning meter. And that in itself is not a very significant thing. That in itself is not a huge revolution, and not an achievement at all. What happens after that, after you abandon the ready-made or the recognizable or the established forms? This is the big challenge of the prose poem, and really the great potential in it, potential for success and potential for failure at the same time, is that now it's poetry out in the open. Now it is the responsibility of the poet to invent or find form. So it's something that I try to make to emphasize in the book, is that the prose poem is not formless, but each poem, each iteration, each installation, each attempt of it in practice is also a big endeavor, because it is a project to discover form, invent form that didn't exist before. And a poem succeeds when it can do that, when it can convince the reader that whatever form it's taking is poetry, or even more challenging, is a poem, is a structure that has tension, that has logic, that has boundaries or edges, even if they are not ones we've seen before.
And one character that you center that does that in a very explicit sense, that idea that the point, the reason for poetry might be many things, but it's not going to be the theoretical perspective or the innovation for the sake of innovation, is Hamed al-Mahmoud. Can you tell us a bit about this person, about his engagement specifically with this whole movement?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that Mahmoud's engagement with the whole movement is just by chance. He just happened to be there. And he was not really as invested in the big claims that some of the other members of the movement made. And his power and the power of his personality and his work is really in his ability to make fun of himself and any big claims in poetry. He is a sarcastic character. There's cynicism also in his work, in his tone, in his language, and in his commentary on the project that he was involved in. And this is why when you come to look for form in Mahmoud's work, it always has to do with how there's a shift in perspective, a twist similar to the way a joke ends, a punchline, some kind of shift in perspective that makes the poem. He was not really big on claiming too much when it comes to rhythm and parallelism and some of the other terms that other prose poets would use to find replacement for the form they abandoned. So I think the poetry in Mahmoud's experience in general and in his writings and his commentary on his writings is just the attitude he has, which is one of divestment from any big claims.
Thank you. Another person about whom you write in your book is perhaps the most famous poet writing in Arabic in the English-speaking world. But not only Mahmoud Darwish. You talk about his engagement with the prose poem always at the distance, but always keeping it in sight. Could you tell us more about this? Anyone who has read Darwish's texts will certainly understand why he would be part of your reflections. But could you cast some
light? Yes. Actually, not everybody would understand why he was part of this book. Actually, a few people objected because Mahmoud Darwish never wrote prose poetry. He never wrote a prose poem. Let me correct myself. Because we can claim he wrote poetic prose or poetry in prose, but he kept himself at a distance from the prose poem project, and he engaged with them in arguments on the cultural pages of Arabic newspapers. And he always remained in the camp of meter. So Mahmoud Darwish is a free verse poet. All of the writings he wrote that he called poetry are qasida tafaila. And his sense of music and rhythm is very clear. And his music is similar to, or a variation of, or coming out of the classical Arabic prosody. But I thought it was important to include him in the book because he himself was intrigued, was tempted by the possibilities of the prose poem. And he flirted with it in many ways. He wrote texts, which he called texts, not poetry, or other texts that he called diaries, installations of prose, highly poetic, that came very close to being prose poems, but he would not call them that because to him, at least there was this assumption or understanding that poetry is still within meter. And another interesting and important dimension of Mahmoud Darwish's engagement with the prose poem is his relationship with Salim Barakat, who is or became one of the major prose poets in Arabic later. He began, his early writings were in meter or free verse. So there's this conversation and friendship between Salim Barakat and Mahmoud Darwish that Mahmoud Darwish uses as an excuse or as a segue, a doorway into some kind of engagement with the prose poem as an idea. and in practice, but without calling it that. So I think he was an important interlocutor from the other side of the binary or the argument or the controversy. Someone who, and I think one of the greatest and most admirable things about Mahmud Darwish as a poet is that he never stopped experimenting. As you mentioned, he's one of the most famous and established poets in the Arabic language and in translation. But until the end of his life, he was trying something new. He was challenging himself. He never rested on his laurels. He always wanted to look for the poem somewhere else. And I think that's what tempted him to the idea of the prose poem and engaging with it. And that's why reading and analyzing his writings, even if though he didn't call them prose poems, tells us a lot about the idea of the prose poem, its possibilities, its failures, and its potentials in terms of criticism and critical reflection.
Thank you. By familiarity, I meant mostly that often the lyrical prose aspect of Darwish also is present in several languages when he gets translated. Salim Bereket is someone you mentioned in conjunction with Mahmud Darwish. He is also not only a focus of one of your chapters, but also, if I understand correctly, a particular favorite of yours. You've translated two collections of his poems. Can you tell us how is it that he interacts with this discussion?
Favorite of mine, I mean, Salim Bereket is an important, one of the most important poets in the Arabic language, and there are a few, right? So this generation is now become a tradition that young poets rebel against, like they have legacies. And I want to comment on the word favorite, just because, again, some of the reaction to the book when it first came out, and the book has been out for a while, you know, things happened in between COVID and then the situation we're in now, that it still feels to me like new, but it's been out for a while, since 2021. So some of the reactions and some of the questions I got when the book first was published, especially from the Arab world, why did you choose these poets and not others? And I tried to clarify or to anticipate this critique in the introduction, and I said, the poets I chose are one constellation among many possible others for studying the prose poem, because it is such a diverse practice and it's not one thing. I could have chose five different poets and wrote a different book and said something just as important to me about the prose poem as what I said in this book. And sometimes the poets who tempt us to write and challenge us are not necessarily favorites. I mean, the word favorite, some of the most annoying and intimidating and challenging and frustrating poets can also be favorites. And it's not necessarily always a smooth and easy relationship. And I think Salim Bereket fits in that category. His reputation in Arabic is that he's one of the most difficult poets. And I don't know what difficult means. I don't think that's it's a productive adjective to use when describing poetry. I think his investments and his engagement, his agenda or his mission lies primarily in some kind of linguistic intervention. He does experiment with form and writes short texts, long texts, narrative texts, deliberately non-narrative texts. But across all that, it is a confrontation, and I, you know, use terms that are aggressive and violent, like some kind of aggressive intervention in the Arabic language, and that's why his views or his practice is very unique and distinct, and it represents a vein under the larger umbrella of the prose poem that is worth studying on its own. I wonder who his heirs are, who are the poets who will follow in his footsteps, because it seems like it's such an intimidating, challenging, deliberately opaque poetic experience that it maybe will not beget offsprings. But it's interesting to see. I mean, he has he's very influential and impactful, and many people look to him. But I sometimes wonder whether his language, his tone, his world is too unique for others to build in it or enter it. I'm not sure if that was your answer. What was that's an answer?
It certainly was, and I appreciate also your correction concerning he's a favorite.
I didn't mean he's not, but you know, I really like to think of these poets as case studies. I don't think it's really, again, useful or productive to say this is a favorite poet. It's more interesting to tell you why I think it's worth spending time looking at his work and engaging with it, and even sometimes in an antagonistic way. And I think that's the biggest compliment a poet can get, is that they leave this impact.
And I would encourage any person who might want to struggle with Selim Bereket to take a look at the translations by Professor Fakhreddin. approaching the end of the book, you have an emphasis on a number of poets who, even though they might have been working earlier, certainly have an impact, and let's say an oversized impact on the younger generations, people who are already writing in the age of the internet. And specifically, you talk about Wadih Saadeh, and even though he was writing much earlier, I think you mentioned that he was part of the Shear group back in the 60s. But can you talk about his relationship? Because much of what you've been saying, including your comments around Selim Bereket, were also about how do poets relate to each other? How does the passing of time, how does the novelty of the form become a granted thing, which now displaces the locus of poetic struggle? Could you tell us about this this last chapter of your book?
Yeah, so the last chapter is really what I was getting at from the beginning. I am frustrated as a scholar of Arabic literature in this country, in the US, by my field, which historically has approached Arabic literature as something that happened a long time ago. And this emphasis on the historical approach, this treating of the Arabic language as if it's something that is theoretical, is dead. I mean, it's something that luckily we've graduated away from, and we've come a really long way. But in general, young colleagues have turned to the Arab world and are taking cues from the literary scene in the Arab world, although translation remains very powerful in creating the reputation and the image of Arabic outside of the Arabic literature, outside of the Arab world. And we have this alternate tradition that's created in translation that might not necessarily match up with the Arabic literary scene in Arabic. So there are these disconnects or these miscommunications almost, or this lack of interest or emphasis or even ability to engage with the moment of Arabic literature as it is today. And yes, the book begins by placing the prose poem or telling a history of the prose poem. How did it begin? We begin in the 60s. And actually in chapter two, I also deliberately make a point of turning to the Abbasid age and this comparison. I'm not sure if I pulled it off or not, but I was interested in also attempting a reading exercise between the prose poem post-1960 and short compositions from the Abbasid age that were deliberately written to be just pieces or qita, short, one thought, one image. And I thought that was, you know, just a gesture, something I'm invested in, this continuum, reading the Arabic tradition as something alive and dynamic and ongoing, and to save it from the historical or historicist approach that makes it seem like it's something that happened a long time ago. So that's why I wanted to arrive. No. Sorry.
And also something you also focus on your book, and I think it's worth noting, a reaction to a specific reading that sees the Arabic tradition merely as sort of a late stage photocopy of the modernist project, which I think you make the point quite solidly in your book that that is an absurd perspective.
Yeah, because I really think that there is no real understanding or appreciation or way into the world of Arabic poetry without knowledge of and investment and love of the tradition. And that maybe the word tradition is something we need to reassess our relationship with. But the qasida, the practice of the qasida is diverse, is innovative, is full of potential and possibility. And the qasida remains present in poetry, in Arabic poetry, even today. I mean, even you can't really understand Mahmoud Darwish, for example, if you are not fully versed in what the talal or loss or nostalgia in Arabic poetry means and what the words, the diction of that is. It's very difficult to appreciate Adonis and his project, its failures and its successes, if you are not aware of his conversations with Abu Tammam primarily and Mutanabbi later and many others. I mean, and Abu Nuwas is present in many of these projects that challenge and subvert and deliberately agitate. And I think the most successful examples of Arabic poetry, modern, pre-modern, whatever you're going to describe it as, Arabic poetry are ones that do that, that encapsulate this entire centuries-long experience in a text that can mean something now, can mean something 1,000 years ago or 1,000 years ahead. So that's why I wanted to end the book with a study of and a reading of poetry, contemporary Arabic poetry. The inheritors of these projects, both the free verse project, Qasidat Tafayla, and the prose poem project, Qasidat Nathar, and to see how younger poets write today and what are their investments. And Wadia Saadi was a good entry into that, because Wadia's poetry, and he says, he makes claims like, I do not care whether you're going to call it a text or a poem or a prose poem. I'm writing. Writing is what I'm after. The open text, this divestment from the big claims, as I mentioned earlier with Mahout, it gets to a different level with Wadia Saadi, and this openness onto other traditions, even if just gestures, you know, mention of interest in American poetry, this idea of language being something that we need to get through to survive, to cross to the other edge, to the other end. The poetry's purpose in Saadi's world is to survive language towards something that's beyond all languages, like I'm not going to say Benjamin's pure language or all that, but translation, I'm not going to use those terms. I don't want to impose them again. But it's a thought that Saadi himself articulates in his commentary and in his poetry. This idea of poetry that's not really tied down to the specificities of one language. It's a poem that can remain a poem in translation, before translation, after translation. And the connection was between him and this younger generation that now writes while thinking of other languages, or sometimes even writes in other languages. And that's where the book ends.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This was a wonderful discussion. Before we pass to the final stage of our conversation, I wanted to ask if you have any projects that you're working on right now that you would like to tell us about, or what you've been thinking in the...
Yes, thank you for that question. I'm sorry my answer is not going to be... It might be disappointing. I do have several projects that I'm very excited about, but sadly I have not been able to do anything or think about anything else. I think this is a moment in our history, and who are we? That you and I are people interested in the life of the Arabic language. And from where we sit, where we stand, this is an unprecedented moment of aggression horrified for months. And I have not been able to do anything other than translate poetry from Gaza or about Gaza or in the aftermath of Gaza. And I think soon we will talk about the Arabic language after Gaza and Arabic poetry after Gaza. This is a counterpoint, the end of time and hopefully the beginning of time as well. The project's put on hold. I mean, it's a project I've been talking about for many, many years, but as you see, I keep delaying it. It's a book on Umm Kulthum as a translator or a communicator of the Qasida in the 20th century. But even there, I find myself now going back to her songs for Palestine and the poems, often not great works of poetry, but very impactful poems that address Palestine. So maybe some other time, Miguel will talk about my other projects. But for now, I'm in this moment and I'm completely paralyzed and hopeless, except when I am reading poetry coming out of Palestine and especially Gaza and translating it, because I need to do that. I mean, the poems don't need me. I need them. I feel that it is a way of fighting back or fending off despair when people who are, you know, experiencing an undeniable genocide can still turn to their language and its art and its music and find refuge there. That's very inspiring and empowering.
And I would say that so many of your translations have been, I wouldn't say helpful, because I'm not sure help is the appropriate word in this context. But they've put us in touch, in contact with, and in solidarity with what is happening in Palestine throughout these months. Your essays, your translations, specifically one that you said you might be willing to read for us, a poem called "From the River to the Sea" by Samer Abu Hawash, if that is still a possibility.
Yes, of course, if we have time. We do?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this is a very powerful poem. And when I first read it, when Sam had posted it on Twitter, it just took my breath away. I felt that this is a paragraph, it's a prose poem, a block, but you cannot but read it in one breath. And that's why I will read the beginning in my English translation and the ending, and maybe skip in the middle if we're short on time, ending in the Arab, in the original Arabic. Yes. Okay, so this is Samer Abu Hawash's poem, "From the River to the Sea." Every street, every house, every room, every window, every balcony, every wall, every stone, every sorrow, every word, every letter, every whisper, every touch, every glance, every kiss, every tree, every spear of grass, every tear, every scream, every air, every hope, every supplication, every secret, every well, every prayer, every song, every ballad, every book, every paper, every color, every ray, every cloud, every rain, every drop of rain, every drip of sweat, every lisp, every stutter, every yamma, mother, every yaba, father, every shadow, every light, every little hand that drew in a little notebook a tree or a house or a heart or a family of a father, a mother, siblings and pets, every longing, every possibility, every letter between two lovers that arrived or didn't arrive, every gasp of love dispersed in the distant clouds, every moment of despair at every turn, every suitcase on top of every closet, every library, every shelf, every minaret, every rug, every bell toll in every church, every rosary, every holy praise, every arrival, every goodbye, every good morning, every thank God, every ala rasi, my pleasure, every hil an samay, leave me alone, every rock, every wave, every grain of sand, every hairdo, every mirror, every glance in every mirror, every cat, every meow, every happy donkey, every sad donkey's gaze, every pot, every vapor, every vapor rising from every pot, every scent, every bowl, every school queue, every school shoes, every ring of the bell, every blackboard, every priest of chalk, every school costume, every Mubarak Ma'ijekon, congratulations on the baby, Every awud bisalamta, condolences. Every ayn al hasood tabla bil ama, may the envious be blinded. Every photograph, every person in every photograph, every niyalak, how lucky, every shtanalak, we've missed you. Every grain of wheat in every bird's gullet, every lock of hair, every hair knot, every hand, every football, every finger, every nail, every bicycle, every rider on every bicycle, every turn of air fanning from every bicycle, every bad joke, every mean joke, every laugh, every smile, every curse, every yearning, every fight. كل ستي كل سيدي كل حقل كل زهرة كل شجرة كل بيارة كل زيتونة كل برتقالة كل وردة اصطناعية يعلوها غبار على منطقة مهجورة كل صورة شهيد معلقة منذ دهر على جدار كل شاهدة قبر كل سورة كل آية كل ترتيلة كل ترنيمة كل حج مبرور وسعي مشكور كل يلا تنام يلا تنام كل دبدوب أحمر في كل عيد حب كل حبل غسيل كل تنورة مشتهات كل فستان يصنع البهجة كل بنطال ممزق كل كنزة تغزل الأيام كل زر كل مسمار كل أغنية كل موال كل مرآة كل مشرب كل مقعد كل رف كل حلم كل وهم كل أمل كل خيبة كل يد تحتضن يدا كل يد وحيدة كل فكرة شاردة كل فكرة جميلة كل فكرة مفزعة كل همسة كل لمسة كل شارع كل بيت كل غرفة كل شرفة كل عين كل نظرة كل دمعة كل كلمة كل حرف كل اسم كل صوت كل اسم كل بيت كل اسم كل شوجه كل اسم كل غيمة كل اسم كل وردة كل اسم كل عشبة كل اسم كل موجة كل حبة رمل كل شجرة كل قبلة كل صورة كل عين كل دمعة كل يما كل يابا كل اسم كل اسم كل اسم كل اسم كل اسم كل اسم كل اسم. Thank you, Miguel.
Professor Fakhreddin, thank you so much. And may our next conversation be in a cafe somewhere in the Free Palestine. Thank you.
May it be there, yes. Thank you, Miguel.